Welcome to Superlative. I am your podcast host, Ariel Adams. In each episode, you will meet someone who has inspired or takes inspiration from today's wristwatch industry. Every week, let's dive deep into the world of crafting exotic timepieces from the people who dream them up to the people who dream of them. It's time to get started and meet today's guest. Hey everyone, Ariel Adams here with the Superlative Podcast. My guest today is Jiaxian Su, otherwise known as SJX or JX. Hey, JX, welcome.
Morning. Thank you for having me.
So you are a fellow watch blogger, if I can even use the term anymore. It's funny how that term watch blogger has changed fundamentally since we get started. When you got started, remind everyone what year it was, but what did watch blogger mean back then?
Well, I guess I got started before bloggers existed, right? Back then, it was still watch forums. So it's people on watch forums. This was the late 90s. I think bloggers only appeared in the early 2000s. You were one of the pioneering bloggers back then.
Yeah. I didn't know you went back to the 90s with the hobby.
Yeah, this was, I would say, 97, 98, when time zone, well, I'm sure you know what time zone is.
Sadly, many people listening may not.
Okay. So for those listening who don't know what time zone is, time zone was probably the first English language watch forum on the internet. It originally started by someone in Singapore, and then it was sold to an American owner. And then it was, it became the place online to discuss watches in English. And then this started in the late 90s. I think, the forums as a venue for enthusiasts, to discuss and congregate, forums probably peaked in the mid 2000s. And then after that, the blogs, people like yourself, they became the go-to source of information for hobbies. And then after that, it was social media.
So you began as a participant in the forum, and then at some point, you started your website.
Yes.
Which is it's interesting, because both your website and my website kind of have almost like silly, simple names. You know, I had a blog to watch. Yours was Watches by SJX, yes. Like so direct, so straightforward, yet so effective. When did you make the decision to go from being a community member to a leader in a sense?
I started the site maybe 10 years, well, more than 10 years ago, in 2010, 2011, so 13, 14 years ago. And I think for me, it was just, I wanted a platform where I could, in a sense, say what I wanted, to talk about the kind of watches that I like. And by then, I guess I knew enough people who were interested in hearing or reading what I liked. And I thought, okay, why not? This might be interesting. Timing-wise, it was also perfect because at the time I had just finished university. So it seemed like a good time for me to try just to try this out, right? Because if it didn't work, I could go, you know, use the degree and get a job. And if it did, maybe it would be something.
What'd you study, if you don't mind me asking?
I studied finance and economics.
Okay, cool. Go on, please. I'm interested.
So I studied finance and economics. And at the time, as you remember, 2010, when I graduated, this was just perfect timing. It was the sort of the tail end of the financial crisis. When I entered university, the greatest job in the world was still investment banker. When I entered university, investment banking was the thing. This was 2006, and then of course 7, 8, 9 was financial crisis, and it became very hard to finance was no longer really a cool thing. So that was probably another reason why I decided to try this out.
Now I want you to talk a little bit more about the forum world, because it's a thing that anyone that got started really in the last 10 years knows nothing about at mm-hmm. all. And you said something interesting. You said that you started the blog because you wanted to talk about what you wanted to talk about. Explain a little bit how the forum community could be somewhat stifling at times.
Well, I wouldn't say it was stifling. Well, okay. To understand it, I think we have to go back to the beginnings of the Watch forums.
Compared to the hyper-democracy of today is the point.
I think it's not just Watch forums, but any sort of hobby forums. When you first started 20 years ago, the only people you find there are people who are really interested in subjects, like the super nerds, the ultra geeks.
Absolutely.
Because these are people who 20 years ago would go online just to read up on their hobby, which was really a weird thing, right? 20 years ago, this wasn't something normal people would do.
And to find like-minded weirdos out there.
So you will get people who will be extremely interested in the topic, like interested enough that, you know, you could say on a forum, it used to be like pages, right? The discussions would go on for pages. There would be like, you know, dozens, hundreds of posts of people, say, debating the merits of the ETA movement in the IWC versus Frank Muller. You know, today it seems really stupid. And today it's not even a thing because most brands have their own movements. But back then, this was a thing, you know. How great is the IWC ETA 2892 versus the one used by another brand versus the stock movement and so on. So these were forums back then attracted people who were really deeply interested in the topic. And also, well, firstly, because one, the internet was new. Number two, watches weren't really a big thing as a hobby. You wouldn't see... anywhere you go, you wouldn't encounter that many people interested in watches. So these two meant that the forums were self-selecting. You got people who are really interested in the topic. And over time, of course, it grew, just like what you see happening in social media today. You get a larger and larger audience because it becomes a cooler thing and more people hear about it. And then that's how forums grew to be like huge. I think by the mid-2000s, most of them were really big. They had hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of visitors. And then everything migrated to blogs, thanks to people like yourself. A lot of the interest, I think, shifted to blogs because that's where you got, in a sense, it's sort of the people you found in forums before, people who are really interested in watches, but instead of doing it on a community-based platform, they did it themselves, right? On their own blog, as it was.
You remember an interesting thing about forums, and not just the watch forums, but all the forums that doesn't exist today. For example, if you're on Instagram and there's someone who disagrees with you, you actually have to respond to them. You actually have to have a coherent argument because that's sort of the nature of the platform. But in forums, there was this sort of very frequent, heavy-handed strategy of just eliminating someone from the conversation or as a user. But you can't do that today. So it was sort of like everyone had a big gun, so you had to be really polite. Whereas today, it's sort of like everyone thinks they can get away with anything. And that's such a stark contrast.
It is a stark contrast, and I think there were pros and cons to the way a forum is run. I think giving people unlimited leeway to debate and to speak, it clearly doesn't work, right? You know, even in the most liberal of democracies, in parliament, in Congress, whatever you call
it,
there are rules, right?
There's always like someone who breaks the rules. Someone ruins it for everyone, right?
I think forums in that time, they were very useful. I think they were really great places to be and to learn about things. But I think the time for that has passed because, like I said, now the center of gravity has moved elsewhere. Maybe one day it will go back to forums if, you know, because, you know, such things, sometimes they go in cycles. And if the audience gets tired of the kind of atmosphere or community you find on social media, then I guess they will try to go elsewhere.
With forums, another thing that was interesting is that there never seemed to be anyone that was a novice. You either had people that knew nothing about the hobby or people that knew a lot. Because in order to participate, there was sort of a requisite level of sophistication, right? You just didn't want to like be a schmuck. And so what you found is that while, yes, you had disagreements with people, people tended to have much more refined and I guess you could say well thought out opinions. Whereas today, I think the hyper enthusiast is actually more in the background and a little bit more worried about participating. And those that comment tend to be a lot of the novices and a lot in the middle, which is it's a total kind of 180. Well, do you agree or disagree?
I think I agree to an extent, because I think firstly, forums, like I said earlier, there was the audience was self-selecting, because you got people who are really interested in watches, because watch forums back then were so new that only people who were extremely interested would go out of their way to go online and to find a watch forum to participate in. Today, I think it's not just in watches, but in many other areas, community or public venues for discussion, you just get a lot of people talking. I think that's just the nature of the internet. It's the nature of social media. There was just, it was in the news, right? Reddit is like a gigantic forum. Reddit went public in the US.
Yeah, which right? is probably going to kill Reddit, let's be honest.
And it went public the valuation was, it was a strong valuation. The stock did well at the IPO, which is actually a testament to how many people want to go online, want to find a community to talk.
But really deeply, because sometimes on Reddit, I'm sure you'll agree, you get a deeper conversation than is accessible via Google anywhere else, really.
Yes, I mean, I'm sure on Reddit, I don't hang out there much, but when I look at the watch discussions there, I think, like you said, some of it could be very deep, very informed, but also some of it is rubbish. So I think this basically,
all you need to be a critical thinker, no matter
what. The spectrum of the internet, which is basically everything. The internet reflects the entire world, so you get everything there. And as a consumer of information, as a reader, you just have to be discerning in what you believe and what you read.
And the funny thing is that in the 90s and today, learning about watches and selecting a watch is in a lot of ways the same process. There's a lot of choices. It's hard to figure out what you like. You can't buy everything you want. And you have to just sort of slowly find the right opportunity while continually whetting your appetite for what's next. Because I think that's what defines all collectors, is they're constantly on the hunt for that next acquisition, right?
Exactly. It's I think the fundamentals of the process remain the same, as you said. I think the only thing that has changed is that now it feels like information is much more widely available. The choice of product on offer is also seemingly unlimited. So now, if anything, the principles have remained the same. The problem becomes too much choice. If you want an opinion, there are too many opinions to listen to. If you want knowledge, there just seems to be too much knowledge out there. If you want a choice of product, also there seems to be too much. And that, I think, is where it becomes more difficult, or not difficult, but it becomes more of more work for the consumer or the collector to judge and discern.
So here's something I've been wrapping my mind around, which maybe you've thought about, maybe not. And this has to do with the difference between when you and I became watch collectors versus people today. And there's a very stark difference. When you and I became watch collectors, and again, you can tell me if your experience is a bit different, it was sort of a solo journey. Like, we got into watches on our own and we developed our taste. And then only after we felt confident did we start engaging in the community. Whereas today, the community comes first. Very few people like become a watch lover in a vacuum and then suddenly find like other like people to talk about. And so I think the point is that when you become a watch lover as part of a community, peer pressure, what other people say, other people's opinions in general, become a much bigger part of the equation. And when you and I got started, we could like or choose whatever we want. No one's like, you're sure about that? There was like no opinions. It was all our own taste. And we had to select. No one said, hey, get that or get that. We were just like, I find that interesting. I like that thing. So by the time we participated in the community, we both knew what we liked and had some confidence. And we're very easy to say, oh, you don't like it, that's fine. Yet if we were just getting started, I wonder if we would act very differently in that community environment. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. I think my experience was actually slightly different from yours, because when I first got into the watches is when I first found the watch forum. So in a sense,
So it did begin with community.
It did, but at the same time, it was really small. Like the number of people you knew, you could probably count on two hands. They're like, right. You know, eight people talking about watches online because it was really niche. So even though there was the community, I think it was different from what you find today because it's very small and very focused. Everybody is, even if people have different opinions, everyone is on the same page in how they want to learn more. They want to understand. They want to become, in a sense, experts in the field, even though everyone is a hobbyist. So that, in a way, was, like I would say, an ideal way of learning about the hobby, because you learn it from people who are passionate, people who are knowledgeable, people who are willing to learn more. And there are not so many of them that it becomes confusing, that it becomes, that it's like a shouting match and everybody's talking and you have no idea what's going on.
So and that's that was, today. You've just described, like, you know, 10 minutes ago on Instagram.
Exactly. Because I think today, social media is, well, social media is open to everyone and watches have become popular, right? Watches have become a thing. You see the mainstream media covers watches, right? When, 3 years ago when the watch market was doing well and prices were going up, the mainstream media, even financial newspapers, they talk about watches as an investment. Now prices have gone down and they say the watch market has crashed.
So well, here's something which is missing, which I think is interesting. You're right. The mainstream media talks about the value of watches in terms of this is an expensive watch. This expensive watch was stolen. This expensive watch was on a celebrity. Whereas, and this is more or less completely ended in the United States. I don't know about where you live, but in consumer media, there's no mention of watches as products to buy, right? It's not like, hey, here's the new watches to get. Like, oh, you know, it's like, here's the new shirts, fine. But you have such little consumer media talking about watches as a product. So you have like financial information about watches, and then you have just like hardcore enthusiast media. Consumer media, because it's mostly gone, and whatever's left of it isn't being like, you know, here's product cover of watches. Would you agree that's missing now and it used to be there?
Yeah, well, I think it is the coverage of watches in consumer media has declined in where I am in Asia, but it's still there because watches are still a fairly big thing in Asia. And also, well, because it's a big thing, watch brands advertise. And once they advertise, the media will in some way cover watches. But I think more broadly, this is happening because of the rise of specialist media online. The consumer media doesn't really need to cover watches because you get so much information online for free from all sorts of platforms. And it feels to me the same in other product categories. Like, you know, if you want to learn about cars, you go online and there's information everywhere. So you don't need to go to the traditional consumer media to learn about any specific category of item.
I just mean, it was cool back then because, I mean, you're right, absolutely. But it was cool back then when someone could look at consumer media, get curious about something, go to Google and then find your website or my website. And that would be their entrance into the world of watches. Now it's a little bit different. It's they see it as a financial thing. Then they play with the idea of it on social media a lot. And then only right before they purchase, they're like, okay, now I got to see what the experts are saying.
I think the financial thing will not be, it will not be a durable topic. Because watches are no longer an investment. For 4 years.
Were they ever though?
Well, for 4 years they were, right? From 2020 to end of 2023.
For the lucky few.
Well, you know, regardless of whether or not they were, people thought they were. The average person on the street, based on what he read in the newspapers or online, thought watches were an investment.
Well, people were like, oh, people buy watches for investment purposes. It was this like notion.
So because of that, I think you created the cycle where everyone is talking about watches as an investment or in terms of value. Because of that was the prevailing notion at the time. Now, that is starting to change. And I think it will continue to change because clearly watches are not an investment, as everybody has discovered since mid-2023.
But they're better than an investment.
Yeah, I mean, they are a hobby.
Which is better because, you know, people invest to make money to do what? Fuel their hobby.
Exactly.
Investment is not an ends to itself.
Yeah. So yeah, you know, I think it will start to, it has started to change, and I think eventually it will revert back to more of a hobby centric thing and less about value, because it no longer makes sense to talk about value because they are not an investment.
Will watches be more of a hobby to more people, right? Like, there's the enthusiasts, will always be there. But the hope, and this is what happened, I think kind of ended in the early 2000s, maybe late 90s, was the mainstream having a little bit more of a luxury watch hobby. Maybe it was because of the strength of the middle class.
I don't think it will. No, I don't think watches will ever be... Well, to start with, for most hobbies are not widespread things, right?
No.
You know? Like
sports, that's a big hobby. That's pretty widespread.
Yeah, okay. I wouldn't consider sports a hobby. Like cars are a hobby. Yes, you know, cars are a hobby in the United States, but not here.
Well, because it's too expensive to have a car.
even in places like say in China, you know, I think like a fifth of the cars they sell are electric cars. In China. So cars are not perceived in the same way as they are in the United States.
It's more an appliance, you're saying.
Yeah, I would say so.
That's interesting.
So I think, hobbies by definition will be quite niche, at least in the sense that people who pursue a hobby seriously.
But it's also fashionable. So you get to wear your hobby and yes, it has a social and communication element
Watches
personal.
Will have a wide appeal for the general audience, for people who want a nice object, a nice watch to wear every day. But that doesn't mean they're in it for a hobby. A person could buy one or two nice watches every 10 years. That doesn't make him a hobbyist.
Well, let me ask you this. When you get attention in public for your watch, does it make you feel good?
Today, no. Because I feel that today it's often the wrong kind of attention. And also because watches have grown so much in value, it's no longer the kind of attention I like. Say 10 years ago, if someone notices the watch you're wearing, it will most probably be because that person understands watches, likes watches, and sees, oh, that's a cool, rare, complicated watch.
And it's today, not that anymore?
Well, today it's more likely than not people notice or recognize a watch because they think it's expensive or they've seen it somewhere as being very expensive.
But isn't the way around that not to wear popular brands even though it might still be expensive?
Yeah, but I think the thing today is that basically, at least in the last 3 years, even the unpopular brands became expensive.
Okay, so that's a big difference between where you live and where I live. And look, for people out there that don't know, Singapore is a very special place when it comes to watch appreciation because for a relatively compact place, there's an awful lot of interest in watches and a lot of watches you can buy. Also, because it's a highly mobile culture, you get to see what's on people's wrists a lot. In LA, you're in the car all the time. You have no idea what people are wearing. The fact that there's a lot of public transportation, people walking, things like that, my understanding is that watches have a high communication value and you can have a little bit more fun with them than a place where it just, again, has to be less people seeing it. So Singapore isn't necessarily the normal, you know, major city when it comes to buying and selling watches. It is very outsized in it. And that's very fortunate for you.
Yes, I think it's. I'm fortunate that I live in Singapore, given that I like watches. I think what you said is true. I think in certain cities where the awareness or the appreciation of watches is higher, you get a lot more people recognizing it. I think the same you could say for Tokyo, Hong Kong, Dubai. These are countries where if you go to a nice restaurant, you'll see like really nice watches. You could see FB Jean, Patek, Richard Mille. Things like this are not a surprise if you walk into a restaurant and you see some of these.
America has a lot of watch appreciation deserts, if you will, where it's a city that might have watch collectors, but you could go to a fancy restaurant and no one's going to wear anything worth noticing. But you're right, in many parts of the world, especially in Asia, any given nice restaurant is going to have fancy watches in it. Like, it's not a question.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Hi, I'm Ariel Adams from A Blog to Watch. I'd like to tell you about Bezel, the modern app for buying and selling authenticated high-end watches. Bezel isn't like other platforms. Bezel was designed exclusively for today's timepiece collectors and enthusiasts, offering choice, convenience, safety, and service. In addition to personally authenticating each timepiece sold on the marketplace, Bezel also offers a personal concierge service to walk you through any part of the watch buying or selecting process. Want something not currently listed on Bezel? Their concierge service is happy to seek one out for you. Buying and selling a watch can be scary as well as challenging, especially with all the options out there today. Bezel uses a modern, intuitive interface to deliver a class-leading technology experience that makes it simple and fun to search through available watches or list one you currently want to sell. Try Bezel today and discover what others like you are already excited about. Get the Bezel app or use the getbezel.com website. That's GetBezel.com. Thanks. This is Ariel Adams from A Blog to Watch with a message from Zodiac Swiss Made Watches. Did you know that the historic Zodiac brand just released an in-house GMT mechanical movement? Through their in-group partner STP, that stands for Swiss Technology Production, Zodiac recently introduced an upgraded Super Seawolf GMT watch with their new caliber STP 7-20 automatic movement. Built in Switzerland, the modern STP 7-20 automatic movement features the local time, a second time zone displayed via a 24-hour GMT hand, and the date. Special features include the use of a silicon escapement for increased performance and environmental resistance. The bold and architectural styling of the Super Seawolf GMT product itself harkens back to Zodiac's history during the 1950s and 1960s as a premier manufacturer of sports activity and professional use wristwatches. Updated for modern expectations, featuring world-class performance and durability, the latest Super Seawolf GMT watches come in a few styles and has a 40mm wide steel case. One of the most popular new Super Seawolf GMT automatic watches for 2024 has a stunning pink and white two-tone bezel matched to a legible black dial. Don't miss the iconic rotating bezel design, interchangeable straps, and strong value proposition Zodiac offers for a watch with this feature set. Zodiac Super Seawolf GMT watches start at just under $2,000. To see them for yourself, visit the Zodiac website at zodiacwatches.com. So let's talk about the business that we're in. I've been full-time in watches for a long time. I went full-time 2 years after I started my website. It didn't take me too long. I don't always know all the things you do all the time, but I'm guessing this is full-time for you.
Yes, it is.
How long before, you know, you were a hobbyist for how many years before you sort of made it your career?
I mean, I was a hobbyist when I was in school. So I made it my career after I graduated from university. So which means I was a hobbyist for, say, maybe, well, all the time I was in school, which was more than 10 years.
Okay.
And then I graduated from university in 2010, 2011.
Okay.
And then that's where it became a profession.
And what would you say you do all the time? Is it the same as me? You know, you write articles, you sell advertising and consulting once in a while, or how do you describe your career when people ask exactly what you do?
Well, I would say I do like you described, basically everything related to watches. So I write about watches, I talk about watches, I sell advertising on the website, I look at watches, I travel for watch fairs. I travel for watch auctions. I talk to collectors. I visit watch stores. So basically, it's everything you could imagine that's related to watches.
And what would you say is your overall goal or agenda points? I think it's important that every strong personality out there explain what they're trying to do or not do. We're obviously trying to tell a story and guide a community. Who's the community you're trying to talk to, and what are you trying to help them do?
Well, I think for me, my focus, I would say, is quite niche, because like I said earlier, this all started with me wanting to talk about the kind of watches I like. So I would say mainly is complicated or high-end mechanical watchmaking with a focus on independent watchmakers.
Okay.
So basically that's what I like, what I'm interested in. So that is also more or less the audience I want to talk to. Yeah. So basically I want to talk to that audience and to tell them what I think, what I like about this particular niche of watchmaking.
But you've gone deeper, because I mean, your website and your coverage is a lot more than just, hey, here's a watch I like. You've analyzed the industry at times. You've analyzed the motivation of watchmakers. A lot of this, of course, stems from the types of conversations that you and I used to see a lot in the forums, where people would really get into psychology and stuff like that. But what are you trying to do better than others? And why do you want people to come to you for something than someone else? I mean, I think that there's a deeper level of how you're approaching it.
I mean, the what you mentioned earlier of analysis, that also is my personal interest, because I'm interested in watches also as a business. Not as a business in terms of me operating my own business, but as an industry. What happens in the industry, what the strategies of the brands are, who the people are, basically how the industry works, where it's going, and as you said, the motivations of the people inside. For me, I think that's interesting, because I think, and I think also that's interesting for my audience, because I think, as someone who's interested in watches, if you are a business person yourself, you will be interested in the watch business as an industry. If you're spending substantial sums of money on something, you would want to know more about the industry. I guess it would be the same if somebody's buying a car for $10 million or $15 million. You would want to understand more about the car industry, more than just saying, I'm buying a Ferrari.
You and I are the same way in that regard, and probably for different reasons, but we are both fans of watches and curious about the watch industry. And I want your reaction to this. And I remember this the first time I maybe went to Baselworld. It was probably about 2009 mm-hmm. or 10. And I remember going and thinking to myself, what the hell is all this? How does this all work? Who's buying all these watches? Where does all this money come from? How do these people even get these jobs? And it's the strangeness of this industry which creates a curiosity. And then us being problem solvers, we want to answer those questions. And sometimes the answers we get aren't that satisfying. So we have to dig deeper and deeper and deeper, right?
Yes. Yes. It's I think it's the nature of also many people who are deeply involved in the hobby who want to know more about something. Doesn't matter what the subject is, but they want to know more.
What are some of the weirdest things about the watch industry to you? I mean, I've made a career out of having columns about suggesting things that can change. The Europeans don't always like my particularly bold and confident approach to that. But I basically say, and again, maybe this is my legal background, but here's a problem. Here's why it's a problem. And here's how I would solve it. What is your approach to all that?
What's your question? What are the problems I see in the industry? Or
well, my approach has always been to write about these types of things in a very overt way. You and I approach these things differently. I guess the question is, are you interested in fixing the industry? You know, are you just trying to figure out how it works? Do you want to start your own brand one day? I think the question is, what is your motivation to analyze it? What are you trying to glean? Because I think a curiosity that we have stems from trying to do something with that information, and just idle curiosity. We're too old for idle curiosity at this point, right? Like we're investigating it for a reason.
I think for me, the motivations, there are several reasons for it. One is quite practical. I believe if I understand how the industry works better, I will be able to perform better as somebody operating in the industry. Because I am part of the industry as well. So for me to be able to survive in it, I have to understand how it works. Now, the question, do I want to fix the problems of the industry or to offer solutions? Yes, to a degree, but usually it would be privately with brands or individuals. Not because that I don't want to say it publicly, but because I only want to help certain brands or certain people. Because one thing I realized about the industry is that it is still, for whatever reason, perhaps because of where it is, because of its history, it's quite an insular industry. The industry as a whole only wants to take advice from its own people.
When did you learn this? When did you learn this?
Well, I learned it a long time ago.
Oh, you were smart. It took me a while. Maybe I just didn't want to admit it.
You know, which is good and bad, right? And that's just how it works. And I think when you go to a fair, like you mentioned, you go to Basel, now you go to Watches and Wonders, when you look at the products that the brands launch, you realize that they only listen to themselves, which is why you have incredible products and also a lot of junk that will not sell, that is commercially not viable.
Well, I think it's the nature of any invention. If you're going to invent something, you have to have a vision in your mind. You have to have some idea in your mind that at least you want this product. And the watch industry, to create successful products, cannot respond to market demand. The market says, give me desirable watches, but that's not really a demand that anyone can answer. Well, so you have to put some creative individual in charge of a final product and hope that if it's good enough for him or her, some other person out there will also like it. And so it requires taking chances and almost a degree of randomness to success, which is the antithesis of any planned corporate anything, right?
But I think what you're referring to is only a very small, a particular segment of the industry that is creating or inventing new timepieces or new products.
What's the rest of the people doing?
A lot of the industry, actually, you're just selling a story. They're not actually creating anything new, but selling what is already known in another packaging.
So, and I think you'll agree with me, the ultimate mix is those companies that can A, create a story, and B, package it. And you know that oftentimes the companies that make the stories are the worst at packaging it.
Yes. I mean, very few companies excel at everything, which is also why there are very few companies that are consistently successful in the long term. I think the number of brands you can count that have been, say, successful for 20, 30 years, you can count on two hands. And this is an industry with thousands of brands.
I think that my growing up in Los Angeles especially helped me understand this intuitively, because there's always this idea that most movies or TV shows aren't going to do well, but the success of the ones that do well is going to be so major that it funds all the other ones. And so for most watches, like most art, to fail is completely not surprising to me. You just have to keep trying it over and over again so that you hit that one that strikes the right chord with communities in general. But the expectation that every brand or every model is going to do well is highly misguided. Yet there are people out there in the industry, you and I have met them, that like genuinely think that like if they put enough love into something that it'll do well. And that's just not how it works, right?
Yeah, well, it's not how it works, but I think because the nature of this industry is one, you are creating a product that is in some senses an artistic product, a creative product, which is why the creators have that kind of passion and they believe whatever they invent will work. But I think the problem is that it is an artistic and creative product, but it is also actually industry that is all about manufacturing. And manufacturing typically demands substantial capital investment, economies of scale for it to succeed. Which is why you look at car makers, they have consolidated over 30 years. Now they're, I don't know what, 7, 8, 9, 10 major car makers in the world. A handful of very small scale niche manufacturers that do very expensive cars. And that's about it. While the watch industry still have thousands of brands and dozens of them launching every year. And this year in particular, we will see a lot of new brands at Watches and Wonders.
Oh, yeah. And I don't think it's going to stop. We always wonder, like, is this the year there's going to be less watch brands? Like, nope. So here's a dilemma within the industry, and I don't know how it's going to work out. And I'd love your thoughts on it. So on the one hand, this industry is a very strong manufacturing industry. There's a lot of things being made all the time. But at the same time, this is an enthusiast industry, which means that production needs to be limited, meaning that like you can't just keep endlessly pouring watches in the market and think that demand is going to stay high. The more watches you produce, ultimately, the lower people are going to spend on each one. So how is the industry going to reconcile the fact that they need to have some discipline in how many watches they make, but they actually need to maintain an industrial infrastructure so that these things can even be made?
I think this is something that will never be reconciled at the industry level, because in a way it's like a game theory, right? You have to see what your competitors are doing. At a brand level, every brand understands this, and the smart brands know what they're doing. Like now, Mark, the business is slowing down. The smart brands are probably going to trim production. But at the industry level, it will never work because everybody wants to, well, sell more watches. And I think the key point is that the strongest brands, the brands that know they are the strongest, know that they will succeed and they will take market share from the competition. That is very obvious. I think if you speak to watch retailers, they will tell you the same. There are brands that over the years have just taken share from the competition. And yeah, I think that's just how it will work.
So maybe the better question is, where should all the unwanted watches go?
Well, you could say they should go here or they should not be produced. But the reality is that they will just go to where they always have gone. They will go to somewhere where you can buy them at a discount. Unfortunately, but, that's just the nature of the industry.
No, I agree. It's just funny because you and I know that having published discounted prices on the internet does have a strong effect of making people not want to spend retail price. But, and we don't want anyone to spend over retail price, but spending close to retail price is healthy for longevity. It's like there's that slippery slope of them going back to the era where, like, you know, no one even thinks about buying at anywhere, I don't know, maybe 25-30%. That's the starting threshold, right? Yeah. And for a lot of brands, that's what happened, you know. I remember when, you know, Omega was like routinely 40% off. Why would you spend full retail on any Omega ever? Now, a lot of brands have worked very hard to change that. And overall, even though I like a discount myself, I agree that's much more sustainable. I just don't know how they don't get back to that point.
I don't think the industry will go to where it was at the worst point of its history. But I think for sure, because it's just a matter of where the market is. Watch brands are still producing watches. Inventory is still arriving in stores. Demand is not what it was 2 years ago. This means that there will be excess supply for certain brands. And once you have excess supply, there will be discounts. So this will, you know, we go back to normal, to what the world was before the pandemic, where some brands you can buy the discount, some brands you cannot buy the discount. Some brands will be considered desirable and difficult to obtain, and some brands will not be. Whereas during the past 3 years, it seemed like everything was unavailable, regardless of brand. So I think we're just going back to where it was before, which is a good thing for the consumer because things are more available. I think there will be more discounts. And also it's a good thing for the brands that have the right strategy, that know what they're doing, because they will grow stronger and they will take market share.
Another big topic affecting the industry, in my opinion, is what I've called fragmentation of online sales. And I would also like your opinion here. And what I mean by that is there's probably too many ways of buying watches online between the number of stores, whether they're authorized dealers or unauthorized dealers, you know, or just a little dealer, the marketplaces, the different platforms, new, used. There's just seemingly too many ways for consumers to buy watches right now, and that can't continue. Where do you think this type of crazy fragmentation is going to go? I assume there's going to be some type of consolidation. It's inevitable. But what is buying a watch online going to look like in 5 or 10 years, in your opinion?
I think it will vary according to the brand. I think the biggest brands, the strongest brands with the most robust demand, they will have fairly limited offerings, at least for new watches. So for instance, you wanted to buy a new Rolex from an authorized source in 10 or 20 years' time, there will be a few options online. I'm guessing those will be the very, very biggest authorized retailers, maybe the brand itself. And that's more or less it. And then, of course, there's a pre-owned option, which I think will still remain fragmented, even though there have been... I mean, there are companies trying to consolidate the pre-owned market. I think it is difficult. I think the economics don't really work, so that will remain fragmented. But for brands that are not so strong with less robust demand, there will be many options because there will be the official option, the retailers, the brand itself. And because these brands are not so strong, they will have many retailers all over the world, some of them offering discounts. And they will also have the gray market option where these brands will where you can buy the watches from these brands, brand new, but at a discount. So I think it will only be confusing for the brands that where they do not enjoy good demand, because they will have no choice but to sell their watches everywhere they can.
So it's going to be a little bit more straightforward for the big box names, but the little guy out there, it's still going to be a wild west.
I'm sure.
I've always said it's going to be quite omni-channel. There's no going to be, because back in the day, similar with advertising, there was like four places to advertise, there's four places to sell your watches. Now, it's basically like the imagination's limit, right? It's like, what platform do you want to spend time on?
I think that is true. But I think for brands that have good demand, they actually have just two options: to sell it themselves or go with the very biggest and best authorized retailer there is. And they don't need to do it in any other way.
Yeah, I think we agree that it's an open-ended question, and that changes will happen. The way it is today is somewhat not sustainable. And I think that too many brands probably are trying to sell direct to consumer. I understand that they want more margin. But what I've noticed is that when brands sell direct to consumer, they don't invest enough in demand creation. And this is often where they tell retailers, like, your job is to generate demand in your territory or whatever. And I guess my question for you is, when it comes to the internet especially, who should the ultimate responsibility be on to create demand? Assuming there's a wholesale type of situation, should it be the retailer or should it be the brand? Who ultimately is responsible for making sure the consumers are curious and want to pursue this product?
Fundamentally, it's the brand. You know, I think everything starts with the brand. The product has to be a good product that people want to buy. The brand has to do a good job of selling it. I think retailers, especially when it comes to selling successful brands, retailers are more there to execute. They need to execute a good store, a good experience, a good after-sales service, good delivery, and so on. Because if you look at it today, you look at the Rolex boutique. All Rolex boutiques around the world, except for one, are run by independent retailers. But all of them look almost exactly the same. So the retailers are there to execute and even, you know, host events and so on. But it really boils down to the brand, what it does with the product, what it does with marketing. Yeah, I think it really is up to the brand. The retailer,
but,
I think, only has a role to play.
But is that an extreme example with Rolex? I mean, you're right.
The other extreme are the niche independent brands. You know, small brands making a few dozen, a few hundred watches a year. Over there, a retailer is arguably more important, because such brands are unable to do their marketing and open boutiques and so on. But in the end, the fundamental appeal of any brand is still the product. So it still depends on the brand to create a desirable product.
But this is ultimately the big fight in the industry right now. It's who's responsible for this? Is the retailer's share worth it? And there's a lot of arguments to be made on both sides. I actually understand both perspectives. But probably for the rest of our time in this industry, there's going to be this struggle between brand wanting to say we're more important, retailers saying, I don't care how important you are, the sale isn't going to happen if I don't do my job. And that is a real ongoing conflict. Sometimes it's more gentlemanly than others, but we've seen this ever since we got started, and it goes on now, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but I think the balance of power between brand and retailer varies according to the brand. For a brand like Rolex, arguably, the retailer has less power because it's Rolex. The retailer
arguably,
also has,
they have no
the
power.
Retailer also has less has less margin because it's Rolex. But it is, I always describe it, it's like buying a bond. If you sell Rolex, you have authorized Rolex. If you're authorized
it's
Rolex
easy,
retailer,
stable money. You won't. You're
guaranteed
make too much,
a return.
You won't make too little.
7-9% a year. You're guaranteed. So it's a good business to be in. If you sell a niche brand, you could make a much higher margin without some of these niche independent brands. But that's a lot of work, and you might not even sell any watches. So I think it really varies, the balance of power. And where it falls really depends on the brand's desirability.
What makes a brand, and I don't just mean a watch, but what makes a brand desirable to an enthusiast like you?
Well, okay. I think what makes a brand desirable to enthusiasts like me is probably different from what makes a brand desirable to the average enthusiast. Because for me, a brand is desirable. Number one, I like the product. But number two, what the brand is doing makes sense. Because for me, if a brand has a strategy that makes sense, I know it will still be around in the long term. And you
give
want
me
to,
example of something that doesn't make sense. Like what's a what doesn't make sense?
You know, brands
sense?
That doubled or tripled or quadrupled their production in the last 3 years.
Okay.
That to me doesn't make sense. The demand went up 3 times in during the pandemic, but that's not sustainable. Or brands that doubled their retail price in 5 years. Again, all of this doesn't make sense. Or brands that are too aggressive in how they bundle watches in order to sell, to get a popular watch and so on. You know, all of these you have heard and seen it, people complaining online.
Sure.
There is a business rationale to all of this, but if you do it too much or do it wrongly, then it doesn't make sense.
Well, I mean, this industry requires absolute perfect execution for, you know, basically trained hobbyists to like you. If you have any flaws,
well, you know, I won't even say perfect execution. I would say brands that do it right 80, 70, 80, 90% of the time, that is enough that they will succeed because everybody else will probably do it wrong most of the time.
So you're so exacting, you even can't say that they ever get it totally right. See, that's hard. They're hard to please, man.
Well, I think there are some brands that get it totally right. But like I said, you know, it's only a handful of brands. Which is why only a handful of brands, you could say, like we discussed earlier, are really, really successful.
We recently had a shared experience with Louis Vuitton. We participated in the Louis Vuitton Watch Prize from very different parts of the world, but we assisted them to make this a real thing. This is the first of many. I guess my question is, what did you learn from this process?
Well, okay, specific to me, because I was a judge, I learned some interesting things about the brands that were participating. That to me was the most interesting.
You mean like reading their applications, right?
No, when I got to speak to them during the judging process.
Oh, okay, yeah.
In the judging session before the ceremony, the brands presented their watches. And because all of the participating watchmakers knew that we in the the judges sort of, well, know what we're talking about, the level of detail, the level of information they offered was extremely high. It was very in-depth. So I've learned a lot of interesting things about the watches, the movements, the philosophy, the strategy, which I think is invaluable. To learn about their product and also what it says about the wider independent watchmaking sphere. And more broadly about the prize itself, I think it shows that Louis Vuitton is serious about being a player in watchmaking, even though it is first and foremost a fashion brand, the biggest in the world, but still fashion leather goods is their main business.
Sure.
But they are approaching the watch business in the right way. Serious. The products are serious. This prize was serious. I think it will just take time for it for the brand to become widely acknowledged as a serious player in watchmaking because it is not known. It is not historically known to be so. But I think what will aid the brand is that many traditional or mainstream watch brands will make mistakes in their strategy, which leaves an opening, not just for Louis Vuitton, but Chanel and Hermes to build up a presence in watchmaking.
I don't see it actually being too far from where we're at today to today's collectors just really falling in love with their type of stuff. Because you're right, some of the incumbents in there, their positions are not as guaranteed and they've been floundering in a lot of areas. And I think one of the ongoing themes that we've been discussing without discussing it is just how competitive the watch industry is. And you and I, from our different vantage points and for our own reasons, are quite interested in seeing the winners and losers and the whys. Why does this brand do better than the other one? Why does this design do better? Why does this manager maybe do better? And there's really no other reason than we're interested to see how good watches come about and how good brands come about because all the academic explanations make zero sense.
Yeah, exactly. I think this observation of the industry is one of the things that makes it interesting for me.
What do you think that Louis Vuitton should take away from this? Like, it's an interesting opportunity. Obviously, they're trying to sort all this out. In your opinion, what should they do with this watch prize campaign that will be ongoing?
Well, I think they should just keep doing it in the way they have, which is to make sure that respected independent watch brands participate, that you have a judging process that people understand is fair, and you have a winner that people respect. Well, I think the winner of the prize, Rahul Tajus, whether you like the watch or not, okay, I think the design is a bit boring, but I think the movement is excellent. The movement is top class. So I respect the product, even though I think the design could be improved. I think this is important for a prize that the industry, not watch collectors, but the industry, other watchmakers say that, okay, this is a product I respect. This is something I think he deserves it. And once this happens, then it becomes acknowledged that this is one of the important important prizes in watchmaking, one of the key events in watchmaking.
I'm going to change topics again to something else that's interesting to me. Now, I'm going to begin by talking about the relationship that Los Angeles and Singapore have to the watch industry. We're both pretty far from Switzerland. We're both not Swiss. And we both represent parts of the world where there's a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of people buying and enjoying watches and also wearing them socially. The one thing that we've agreed in this relationship is that the insularity of the watch industry means that they don't want a lot of outside opinions. And that is also translated into not having a lot of outside hires. Should they think more about hiring people from our neighborhoods to really help them? Or is there some type of special sauce of them doing their own thing and us buying it and them never quite listening? You know what I mean?
Well, I know what you mean. And I think, I think it is slowly changing amongst the younger generation of people in the industry who probably are not yet at the senior level, but because of the exposure, the way they've grown up, they grew up with social media, I think they are less insular than the earlier generations. That said, I think it is difficult for these brands to hire because of where they are. It is very difficult to get someone to move to Le Brasseur or Le Sentier or Neuchâtel, even though these, you know, towns are the great outdoors and you have the mountains and the lakes and the animals. For people who come from a city, that's in the middle of nowhere. So to get someone to move there is actually very difficult. And I think that is one of the key challenges for brands in recruiting, even if they want, and even if they're open-minded and they want to hire all sorts of great talent from around the world, it's very difficult to get to people to move there. And it's the same for outside of Switzerland. Say a brand like Lange. Lange has moved its management functions, marketing, PR to Berlin. Because I think it was difficult for them to get young, talented marketing executives to move to a town outside Dresden, near the border with the Czech Republic. While Berlin, being, you know, hip and cool city, is easier to hire.
Because the nightlife.
You know, I think it's just a matter of where the brands are. So, okay, despite what I said earlier, I think in a way also, even, it's not entirely the brand's fault. Because it is just really difficult to get to people to move to such places, especially if they come from a big city.
I agree with you on that. And I think the correct response is to sort of remind everyone that even though the watch industry does business all over the world, it is still very much operated like a cottage industry with a relatively small number of decision makers. Their worldview is limited, and that benefits us because it means they put the time and effort into making these watches that any big city company would be like, that's dumb. But it also is a detriment because they can't really understand the way that the people who buy their watches around the world think, right? So they might agree this is a beautiful product, but there's a lot of other things that they sort of don't agree on. And that's part of the charm. But nevertheless, there's still a lot of people around the world who want to work in the watch industry. And I'm sure you, just like myself, have had so many conversations or people reaching out that I don't respond to that want to get in the watch industry and find it hard. And my question, I guess this is the last question we have time for, is should the watch industry do anything to help all these motivated people, you know, I don't know, become salespeople, technicians, staff, things like that? It seems like the recruitment only happens in the French-speaking part of Switzerland. Outside of that, there doesn't seem to be any broad effort. I don't know where to send people's interest if they want a job in the industry. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, they could recruit more. Should they do something with this?
I think the watch industry does a decent job recruiting for their locations and offices outside of Switzerland. Each of the brands, the offices in Asia and so on. You get a very international group of people. In Switzerland, like I said, I think the difficulty is the location. Even if you want to join, it's difficult because of where it is. But I think for someone who wants to join the industry and to rise and to be management, I think the route in is still a very traditional one, where involves either having a background already in some related industry, or getting qualifications from universities that specialize in luxury management. You'll see, especially now, many of the more senior or mid-level youngish executives in the industry, they have an MBA from one of these universities that specialize in luxury management. So whether or not that is useful or will help you succeed in the business, I think is that maybe not, but it is a way to get in, because that is the qualification that the brands look for and the brands will hire. But whether or not it's useful is another topic entirely.
For people right there in Switzerland, you're right, there are some ways in. Well, tell me if you've noticed this. In the United States, where I communicate with a lot of the brands, marketing and PR people, we notice that when someone leaves a job, they just end up working at another watch company. Or more accurately, when there's a vacancy, rather than hire anyone new, they just find someone who has more or less the same job and try to poach them over from another company. That says to me that at least here, they do have a recruiting problem, because they can't seem to put any effort into finding new people, even though there's plenty interested. It's just the same people they keep bringing in.
It happens quite a lot in Asia as well, but I don't think it's a recruiting problem. It is because a lot of the knowledge in this industry is so specific that it makes more sense to hire someone who already is familiar with the industry and the product than to hire someone from outside the industry and to train them from scratch. Because even if you're not a watchmaker, if you're only a marketing VP or marketing manager, you have to know what a tourbillon is, minute repeater, free sprung balance wheel, regulation, high frequency chronograph. Stuff like this is very, very specific to the industry. And I think because at least at the high end, the watch industry markets itself in quite a technical way, the people in it need to understand the product. They need to learn. So, I can understand why brands want to hire people from the industry, because it is actually very challenging to teach someone who's completely fresh what a free sprung balance is. It's just challenging.
It is. And I guess I said that was my last question, but one more. Mm-hmm. We've been doing this long enough to realize two things. One, the watch industry is very sticky, right? Once you're in it in some way, it's very difficult to get out. And even when you do, you want to get back in. We see that all the time because it's a hobby and it's sort of fun. So that's one thing we've established. But also, we have long-term vision, and we recognize we can't necessarily do all the traveling we do or do all the jobs we do forever. And so my question for you is, have you thought about a long-term goal? Maybe not all the steps, but where would you want to end up after the accumulation of the stuff that you are doing now and can see yourself doing for the next little while?
Well, I think in the last 1 or 2 years, I think my vision might have changed slightly, because I think in the medium or even the long term, actually, I think this media business is going to become very difficult, so much so that it might not be as viable a business as it was before.
Maybe. Could go the other way too.
it could. But for me, it feels like odds are the media business might not be viable because there are too many platforms. And it's just
so let's be specific. You're saying the support with perhaps making money at it. So the popularity of the content and you being able to monetize it, as you know, are two different challenges.
Yes, exactly. So for sure, there'll be people interested in watches. I think monetizing it will be difficult because there's so much free content. And just the other day, I was reading. What was I reading? I think I was reading the New York Times, and it was saying that, I think in either a big city or in the United States as a whole, most young people get their news from social media, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, whatever, and not from newspapers. right? Which is why newspapers, respected newspapers, Washington Post, New York Times, find it difficult to make money. So more people get news from social media, which is free, than from the mainstream media. And I think the same thing is happening for specialist media that talk about watches, cars, whatever else it is.
You're right. That is the trend happening right now. My argument is this. People, culture will eventually determine it's more effective to spend a dollar and 1 minute to get my question answered than do it for free and spend 5 hours and try to figure it out.
Yes, but I think the thing is that hinges on the reader or the audience being able to discern what the correct or the good information is.
Yes.
If you cannot absolutely discern that, then everything on social media, everything that's free looks good. I think that will be a challenge, and specific to watches, because watches compared to other segments or other fields is very, very niche. You cannot get 10 or 20 million paying subscribers for a watch magazine. I don't think you can even get 1 million paying subscribers. So even if you pay only a dollar a month, I think it's very difficult because the costs are too high.
I'm banking on the business model of media changing in the future. I still think that there's demand.
How do you think it will change? Where will the revenue come from?
I see a big potential in what I call microtransactions. I think people would pay 5 cents to read an article they think is useful. Nobody wants to pay an ongoing subscription fee for one thing they want to do. I think people will be very generous if they recognize there's a small amount of money. As you know, there's a lot of barriers to being able to move those small amounts of money without large tolls and gateway fees. Mm-hmm. So we're not really there yet. I also think that the Facebooks of the world will return to being platforms that require quality content, else people will just go elsewhere. I think this sort of trend of everybody donating all their time to making a content on social media, like that's not sustainable either. People eventually get jobs again. So I think that the role of content creators is going to come back because the platforms are going to need them again. There's going to be more of a symbiotic relationship between the two. And you're already starting to see that. So I agree with you. If you look at current trends, it's not looking rosy, but I have to assume it's going to crash at some point and then, you know, society will reset and it won't be in the distant future because these things, you know, change quite frequently.
Yeah. I mean, if the demand for traditional media comes back as you predict, then I think that will be good for all of us.
I long time ago asked Jean-Claude Biver about this topic. I was like, what should I do with myself? And he really thought about it, and he really said, just don't stop doing what you're doing. Because similar to, you know, famous designs like the Royal Oak that took a damn while to become popular, if we continue to do what we do long enough and we're somehow doing it, there's a reason why it's continued to work. And we should just keep getting better and better at that. But I didn't want to derail you. You said that you didn't think the longevity of media. And so what are you going to do in the watch industry next in your future assessment?
Honestly, I haven't decided.
The hard question.
Yeah, I mean, there will be a couple of options. One would be to do something differently, entirely different. Yeah. I could go and do an MBA and go and do something else in another industry. Another could be to monetize the site in a different way, to monetize the site in a way that many other people are doing, which is to sell more stuff. To do e-commerce, to become a retailer of sorts, which I think has its own challenges. And I'm not sure that
I don't think you want to do that.
I don't know if I want to do it, but I think doing it requires, you need a different setup with very high operating expenses. So I think profitability becomes a challenge.
And the competition. Fiercely competitive.
Exactly. So, these are a couple of options that have come to mind. I haven't decided because also I think now it is not clear yet, at least in the medium term, where the watch business is going. I think it is clear that the business is slowed down, whether it's a secular slowdown, a persistent slowdown, or it's just a temporary thing that's going to come back like crypto has come back and reached a new high.
So, don't compare watches to crypto. Come on.
You know,
Why don't you do something?
It's not just crypto. I mean, financial markets are also all-time high. So will this optimism feed into the watch business? It hasn't yet, but I don't know.
We'll see. We'll approach this discussion a little later out of time.
During Watches and Wonders in 2 weeks, this will be interesting to see how much retailers order from the brands. And that will set the tone for the rest of the year.
We're a couple of weeks from figuring it out. SGX, tell everyone where they can learn more about you or find your content on the internet.
Well, if you Google SGX Watches, you'll find the link and you can find my content there.
This has been the Superlative Podcast interview with Jiaxian Su. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ariel. Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Superlative Podcast. This show relies on support from you, the audience. Please subscribe, review, and share Superlative with your friends. To get the latest watch news and enthusiast commentary, also listen to the Blog to Watch Weekly podcast. For show ideas, comments, or business, please contact us at podcasts@blogtowatch.com.